anyone listening to me? Can I talk to you for a second?
Oh my God, I was dying.
You totally have to hear this. Do you have a minute right now?
It's important, okay?
Just keep it on the dime. Just keep it on the dime.
I feel like you're not ready right now.
Welcome to the Overshare Show. I'm Grace.
I'm Tony. And today we're going to be talking to Anna Matronic, who is one of the lead singers of the band The Scissor Sisters.
She was someone I was really intrigued by because her life seemed to have this overarching congruent theme to it. I'm always impressed with people who seem to come into this planet with like a master plan of some kind.
Like a greater purpose that has been written out by the universe that they're just following along for the ride.
It just seems like there was such consistency with the influences in her life as a child, you know, what she was interested in growing up, how her career unfolded. It was just sort of amazing considering that my life looks like a patchwork of mishaps and false starts and like temp jobs. Like, I'm always impressed with people who know what they want to do. My brother, for instance, told my mom when he was 6 years old, I'm going to be a dancer. And lo and behold, right now he's dancing somewhere. And, you know, there was this sort of seamlessness between her life and her art where she talked about being majorly influenced by Joseph Campbell. And listening to her, I felt like, you know, it was the hero's journey. Like Joseph Campbell could have been giving a lecture and used her life as an example of a, you know, modern myth where, you know, she was influenced by the archetypes in religion and they just ran this theme through her life and her struggles and her, the finding of her tribe. That was a big part of her journey and I think is really apparent in the culture around the Scissor Sisters.
I mean, I think this idea of tribalism is fascinating because what Anna was searching for was a community of acceptance. And that's what she's created with the music. I mean, I think the Scissor Sisters embody an idea of acceptance, both through gender and sexuality. And when we look at our postmodern times, when we're so isolated and we don't have, especially in America, we have nationalism to a certain extent, but we don't necessarily all have a common communal culture. So I do think a lot of us are searching for an identity of belonging, you know, and here the Scissor Sisters was celebrating the idea that you can belong as part of this community, yet within your individualism, you know, you can express yourself completely and fully, and we're not going to judge you, and nor we're going to expect people to be the same as each other, but together as these abstract and extreme versions of ourselves, we are community. We are together. We are belonging.
Yes. Even in talking about the latest part of her performance and creativity is solo work, but she talked about it being a family experience because she's connecting with just a lot of different groups and making new music, which we're really excited to hear. So I hope you enjoy. And this is Tony and Grace with Anna Matronic.
Anna, one thing I really need to understand about you is your feeling on transhumanism, considering that your name is Anna Matronic.
Yes.
Can we please talk about how you feel about cyborgs, transhumanisms, and machines?
It excites me very much. I was a very young kid when I experienced The Bionic Woman on TV, and I was hooked from a very early age on the idea of artificial intelligence and robots. Of course, there's lots of really great sci-fi in the late 70s, Star Wars being a big one. Battlestar Galactica, the Cylons were particularly sexy to me. And then became much sexier later on in the new incarnation of Battlestar Galactica. But anyway, I really enjoyed robots and all things sci-fi. And then when I was studying pop culture in college, and you're about to have a friend come and join you on your lap. I was studying.
That sounds really hot and sexual, but that friend is a cat.
But yeah,
just so you guys know, it's not a hot man. Okay, so you're studying pop culture.
There he is. Aw. He's a connoisseur of laps, P.S. Anyway, I was studying studying pop culture at my really illustrious and storied community college in Vancouver, Washington. And this goes back to my mom and growing up. She was into Joseph Campbell growing up.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And he was a presence in our home. And this crazy class, they showed a little bit or just a little tiny clip of Joseph Campbell talking to Bill Moyers in the Power of Myth series.
I've actually watched that series love it.
I love that. And I know that he advised George Lucas a lot. And I think they brought that up in the series.
That's why it was shown in my pop culture class. So then I was at that time super obsessed with the Bionic Woman. I had just sort of rekindled my love of her. And at the time, I was scheduling classes around watching the Bionic Woman on the Sci-Fi Channel because it's on every morning at like 10. So I'd make sure that no classes were on at 10. Which is just dumb. Who cares?
But or that's, not.
That's
or brilliant.
That's who I was at the time. And so we had to do a presentation in the pop culture class, and I did one on how Jamie Summers is not only a woman of the 21st century, but a goddess surrogate, and how she can be seen as the nexus and the coming together of science and nature. And she no longer do they have to be at odds because they are at whole in the body of this mother goddess figure, Jamie Summers. And then I went so far as to create a religion called Bionic Love using Jamie Summers as muse and messiah figure, sort of. And I did a zine. Because, that was the, pre-internet. Everybody had a zine. And from that, I then discovered Donna Haraway, the writer Donna Haraway, who is she's a professor of sociology, and she wrote the Manifesto of Simian Cyborgs and Women. And she talks about transhumanism and... What fascinates me about it is the idea of humans taking an active role in their evolution.
Yeah. Do you feel like now, from when you were talking about this like initial obsession and interest in the mother goddess and technology, do you feel like that's where we're heading still? Or do you feel like we've kind of transgressed or we're not using technology to its highest capacity? I mean, how do you see things as they are right now? And do you feel like it's fulfilling your initial dreams that you had in college?
One thing that comes to mind is the movie Her.
Definitely. That's actually been explored in some of the really cool, there's a really great book called She, He, and It about a sort of love triangle of the future. And I think what's really cool about technology now is that it's inescapable and people are becoming creative with it in ways that I never really foresaw. The idea of taking a hilarious clip from the news and turning it into a song or, auto-tune the news or bad lip reading, all of these things that are enabled by technology and allow the tiniest, littlest bits of creativity to come out of people. I think it really is technological and it really is spurring a great deal of creation. Everybody is creating, and that's a really positive, very, very feminine thing, obviously, to be creative. I think women are inherently creative just by being women. Having babies is sort of an obviously inherent creation and being tied to that biologically. But the muses, the idea of that sort of embodiment of creative energy, all the muses are female. So there's something that is really, I think, inherently feminine about being creative. And so,
was that kind of the inspiration for your name?
Well, my name is Anna, and around, let's see, what year was this? It was the 90s.
Reality Bites was a thing.
It was not quite utilitarian chic era. Oh, but that was a good time for me. It was a little sort of post club kid era, or getting to be post club kid era. And I was doing a drag show in Portland dressed as a robot. And I was talking to my friend Michael, who was my roommate at the time, about the performance, and just saying I was gonna, you know, do lots of robot dance moves and hopefully look like an animatronic puppet. And as soon as animatronic came out of my mouth, we both just looked at each other, and it was, you know, that bing of inspiration. We both went, oh my God, animatronic.
It's too brilliant. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it just seemed right.
It's interesting because you were talking about developing this character and looking at it as a nexus of things. And I feel like there's so many parts when I was, you know, reading things about your life that fit together, you know, how it evolved, you know, inspired somewhat by your mom's paintings of the iconography in Istanbul. And particularly with that, I was wondering about, you know, how being around those people, the mystics or religious people, what was that like? What were some of those experiences like? Just some of the people that you came across.
Well, I had a really interesting tie to history through my mom's art. And then I was baptized Greek Orthodox. And we went to Greek Orthodox and Russian Orthodox churches all throughout my childhood. And on the one hand, it's annoying because you have to go to church every Sunday. On the other hand, they're doing it in ancient Greek. So you have no idea what the hell they're saying. It just sounds like all these magic words. And everything is sort of song in this. You know, it's very similar with cantors in Judaism. And so you have this super old world feel to it. And there's this magical feel to it. And you sort of, has a real, I don't know, fantasy. You get into the myth of it.
Well, there's a real theater, and there's definitely...
Yes.
And I mean...
As my mother would call them, the bells, smells, and midget races. You know, ringing the bells and the incense and the altar boys all running around.
And can you talk a bit about, you know, when the Scissor Sisters began and how that influence of mysticism and fantasy, you know, bled into your work and just like the evolution of that a bit.
Well, I guess it just meant that I always liked to play dress up, and that's where I got into drag. That was basically just through friends and through the circles I was running in. And then that's how I met Jake, was being involved in cabaret here in New York. And we met through a mutual friend, and I invited him to perform. And he did a couple times, and then when he asked me to join the band, it just seemed like a natural thing. Like, oh yeah, great, more dress up and kookiness.
Were you always a singer? I mean, when you were young, was that something you pictured for your life?
I always wanted to be in a band, but I wasn't a singer. I was an actor and performer, and I always had this really deep voice, which I still have. And I got made fun of for my voice a lot growing up, and asked if I was really a boy and things like that. And so I was told that I could never sing, because when you're a little kid, you're singing these really, 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 and I could never sing them.
Like, so, I can't sing the drummer boy, okay? It's just not in my register.
No, and I just didn't even know. You know, I didn't even know that
the options out there.
Yeah, like, I didn't even know there were options. and then later on, just through doing drag and getting involved in cabaret, I started singing again. And
was that at Tranny Shack?
That was at Tranny Shack in San Francisco, yeah.
And then you moved Tranny Shack or some form of it to New York. And I was curious what that was like. What was the difference between, you know, working on a project like that in on the West Coast as opposed to New York?
And starting it here yourself.
Well, Tranny Shack was very free and fun and open, just like San Francisco is. And I loved it. It was really, really fun. And then it just, moving to New York sort of took me by surprise. I had friends who were getting ready to move back to San Francisco. One was moving to San Francisco. One was moving to Tokyo. And so it was my last time to come and visit them. And it just so happened that my friend moving to Tokyo had this great job and they wanted a replacement. He had to give his notice and he's like, oh, well, my friend is here and she wants to move to New York and we should give her a reason to. So I just thought I would go check it out and see what it was about. And they offered the job to me on the spot. And so I just sort of saw it as this, you know, too good to pass up. And it was sort of the universe telling me that I needed to
be here.
Yeah.
But then what made you want to bring Tranny Shack to New York?
Well, I didn't necessarily bring Tranny Shack. It was friends of mine that had also moved here. And this was sort of the height of the Giuliani era. And nightlife had kind of died and there wasn't a whole lot of fun to be had. It was few and far between. And so this club, the Slipper Room, which is still around, had just opened up in the Lower East Side. And we went in, got in with them on the early side. And I had just lived a couple blocks away from them. So that was great. Stumbling distance, I like to say. then we started Knock Off, which was a knockoff of Tranny Shack. That's why we called it that. Had a midnight drag show and it was cheap to get in and cheap.
Can you say some of the theme nights that you guys had? Because those titles were so funny. We were like dying laughing. I'm like, why can't I go to these events now?
Yeah, I know. We should maybe have a reunion and restage some of them. It'd be fun. Knockoff always had weird themes. We liked to bring varying and conflicting elements together. So we had, I'm drawing a blank. Okay, one was office politics. One, there was Origami Orgy, Shake Your Buto. That was a good one.
That's so brilliant.
Dada A Go Go. That was one of my favorite nights. What else? Aerobic Rapture was one of the nights.
That's awesome.
Aerobic Rapture, that was pretty good.
Would you say that these events had like a performance art element to it?
Oh, definitely. Because everything ran the gamut from, you know, straight up drag to, you know, we would have people coming on stage in garbage bags, not making any sense whatsoever. And you're like, what in the hell is that? And we were going for that, late 70s, early 80s East Village inspired, you know, I wanted to be Ann Magnuson and was just looking for my tribe. Looking for Joey Arias and Keith Haring.
It's interesting because we were talking about how, and in part this has to do with the technology today and, you know, these little sort of niche groups, these underground groups. It's almost like fractals, like, you know, these little pieces of creativity that are reproduced and just get bigger, but they're accessible to so many more people.
Yes.
And I mean, do you think that the Scissor Sisters would be as popular in another era?
Yeah, I never really understood why we were popular. to be quite honest. I just always thought we were too weird.
When did you know when we were like, oh, this is a big deal?
I'm a part of something and it's awesome. Like, I mean, I'm sure you always felt that way, but did you have a moment where you were like, this is going to be much bigger than I ever anticipated?
Yeah. It was when things started taking off in Britain, that was when it was interesting, when it went from, okay, we're our first tour, we're opening up for somebody, and that was the thing. We went around the UK. Then it was come back and do a small club tour, and you start seeing the same people, and they start showing up at like every show. And then it's like, okay, come and do a bigger. And then it's like, it's your third time in the UK, and you're like, okay, something's going on, and people want to talk to you, and people want to know things. And but when it really hit home was when we played the Glastonbury Music Festival in June 2004, which is almost 10 years ago. It's the 10-year anniversary this year. And it was about 6 months after our record had been released, and Take Your Mama was kind of the single that was out, and people were hearing it and enjoying it. And I think what really clicks for people is when they see us live. And that's when it really all sort of comes together. And Glastonbury is a huge festival. It's the biggest festival in Europe, I think. And it's broadcast all over on the BBC. And so everybody's watching it at home as well. Not everybody, but, you know, lots of people. and we played, we had a gig originally in the dance tent at night, and then they asked us to play the main stage in the afternoon. And so that's when we knew, okay, this is a big deal. This is a lot of people, and it is, you're playing in front of so many people, they don't even fit in your eyes. It's so crazy.
I see.
It is. It's, yeah, you're, I don't know. It's like, this must be what, you know, Hannibal was looking at on the back of an elephant. Like, people just screaming, and there's banners everywhere, like, rah!
And that's how you end up with the Nuns, or like, yeah, I mean, that sort of evolved into that. I mean, that's definitely another level of fame when you have
your own sexuality.
When you have your own sexuality and a group of people that you know, which I think is also interesting that they are the Nuns, like a religious kind of figure too.
Yeah, well, we called our fans the Scissorhood from the very start. And one time on stage, I thanked the nuns and monks of the Scissorhood, and I sort of gestured to these kids who were coming to every show, and they were you know, right down in front every show. And one of them in particular, Prue, who lives in Australia now, took that to heart and was sort of like, I'm a nun. And that's I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was Prue who named the sort of Anna fans nuns.
I mean, what is it like for you? What did it mean to you when people would call themselves like Anna sexuals? And, you know, I mean, obviously it's incredibly flattering, but how did you see it on like a meta level? Like, what did you feel was that messaging that was speaking to you?
I thought it was funny because Anna, A-N-A, is also anorexic on some speak, so I'm really far from that. So I kind of liked that aspect of it. And it's very, very flattering and sort of scary. You just hope that nobody ends up sort of knocking at your door. Strange.
Right. Time. No stalkers, please. Nobody stalker.
No.
So one thing I'm curious about in terms of your live performance is that, what was your initial vision? Like, what did you want to bring to the live performance experience? And like, were you able to manifest that fully in the past, you know, decade?
Oh, wow. for me, performing was always something that answered something really deep within me. It was always my favorite thing to do. And it didn't really matter what it was, just as long as I was in front of an audience. So the, in particular, live performing is yes, just what I live for, really. And there's something there's something about connecting with people. It's probably abandonment issues or something like that. I don't know. Regardless, there's really something about connecting with a room full of people, and of making a room full of people who may normally not get in the same room together and understanding their similarities for just a second.
There's also this theme of a certain level of excitement too. Like there's this super energy that you bring. It's not a mellow connection. It's like ecstatic.
Yes.
What was that? Was that part of it, your vision?
Well, I mean, a part of that, a lot of that is feeding off the energy of Jake, who is nothing but ecstatic. I mean, we kind of had to work over the years on slowing him down. Because he just would come on and was the Tasmanian devil. And so I actually tend to move, or before that would move a lot slower than that on stage. And so I sort of had to speed things up to look, to match him a bit, but to also, you can't do exactly what he does, because then I wouldn't be able to sing because I'd be completely out of breath. I perform out. I'm very much an outward performer, and I'm very much about connecting with people. So making eye contact and singing to people, and you know, making sure that everyone in the room has a moment.
A moment to, you know, be intimate with you.
Yeah, or with the music, or feel like they're being sung to, or, you know, that's the thing. That's the reason why people come see live music, is because they want to take what they hear in their headphones and have this personal experience with, and they want to make it manifest.
Is that when you go see a performance, when you, you know, who are you fans of? Who are your inspirations? Is that what you look for when you go see someone?
Oh, for sure. There's definitely something to people who are so into what they do that they are lost in it and they kind of have a wall up. I had the real pleasure of seeing PJ Harvey on her first tour and her second tour. And the difference between her as a performer on those two tours was amazing. And there was something inherent in her as a performer that you could see on the first tour, on the dry tour, where she was sort of hiding behind her guitar and hair was pulled back and there was a jacket on, and she'd maybe say thank you between songs. And then she, for some reason or another, or, you know, came out and had created a bigger persona and came out as a performer. And on the second tour that I saw, on the Rid of Me tour, she was in a fierce leopard print dress and her hair was down and the eyes were painted blue, and she was looking at people and connecting with people, and she'd really kind of come out of her shell. And I loved both, because she was so connected with the music that she was communicating what it was all about. And that's really, to me, what a good performer is someone who communicates what is being said or felt in the music.
One question I have about, you know, being a woman and mm-hmm. a woman front woman, mm-hmm. you know, and this like element of sexuality that, especially in modern culture, women are really pressured to be much more sexual. I mean, the other day we were watching Janet Jackson,
yeah.
and she's dressed like a soldier in her videos, or, yeah. you know, she has like a giant trench coat,
yeah.
and she's just dancing and singing. So for you, like, what has it been like integrating your sexuality? You know, have you felt marginalized or objectified, or, you know, what's your relationship to your sexuality in your persona on stage?
I'm really lucky that I'm part of a band, so the focus wasn't always on me. And I loved that in Scissor Sisters, it was the guy who got his clothes off. And I think that was something that we always wanted to maintain. And partly it was because I didn't want to get my clothes off. I do have a funny sort of ladylike tendency as well. I like to be a lady. And for as sort of in your face as I can be, I like that to be more with words and ideas rather than my ass. And that's not to say that I, and it's not to begrudge people who want to put their ass in your face. Get it in my face.
That is kind of a refreshing change of, you know, the role, like a gender role on stage where, you know, you're the, you know, yeah, the more grounded energy on stage and, yeah, like, you know, the more out there sexual.
Yeah, he's sort of the unbridled energy. But I was very free, and I always have been very free to express my sexuality exactly as I saw fit, because I, from, you know, at least the late teens, surrounded myself with mostly gay men and women, and that was a very, very, very sex positive, very gender fluid, very nurturing environment to express myself in.
It seems like a lot of your family experience was very supportive and loving, and it struck me that it was unique because a lot of people have to kind of break out of their family roles in order to find themselves, that there may have been an element of the opposite for you, where, you know, your family was very open and honest and supportive, and maybe some of the outside world couldn't have, you know, there might have been a filter for that.
Like, did you feel in any way like oppressed by the society of which you grew up in? And how did that, like, if you did, you know, how did that inform your art? Like, was there anything you were reacting specifically against or towards?
No, I think I was always raised with a real understanding of my privilege and where I came from and what my family did. And we weren't wealthy by any means. And there were issues that I had growing up with feeling different. I was a fat kid. I was a weird kid. I was a nerd. I wore glasses. I had braces. I had bad teeth, you know, all those things that you get teased about. I never felt oppressed because I always knew who I was. I had a lot of love in my family, and I knew I was a smart kid. And so if I knew that if I worked and rose above all that bullshit, that that I would find my tribe. And that was one thing that my mother always instilled in me. You know, she was a weirdo, so she knew what it was like being a weirdo. And she found her friends, and she found her voice in what she loved to do. And she knew that I would find it eventually too. And I knew I would find it eventually too. Going back to what you asked, I was, I think, being aware of privilege and where I came from. The focus was always on making things better, leaving this world better than I came into it. So it was more on service. And, you know, my mother, as being an iconographer, being involved in the church, being involved in the story of Christianity, being raised with the true idea of the connection to Christianity, which is to have your own relationship with the word, whatever the word is. And there's all kinds of words that you can engage in. Make sure it's a personal connection. And the archetype of Jesus Christ is a very, very good one. We all need a little Prince of Peace in our lives. And it's it's the dogma and the bullshit that surrounds it that needs to be cut away. And when you get to the when you get to the heart of it, it's about brotherhood, sisterhood, charity, and work toward betterment. And I have everything I need. I'm blessed to have what I have, and it's about making good for others as well.
You definitely did find your tribe, and it
seemed, did.
And in terms of finding your voice, now you're on another, you know, branch of a journey in sort of more solo work.
Yeah.
What has that been like in bringing that message in a different way?
It's been really fun. It's been very, very fulfilling, which has been really nice. I've been working on music with my husband. I've been working on music with my dear friend, Bridget Barkin, who's amazing. And I've been working on the visuals with my husband, with my dear friend Juan Carlos, working on stage production with friends, with the House of Ninja, which has been incredible. So it's been this real family affair, and I'm not doing it with a record company. I'm going to wait until the record's finished, then I'll shop it around, see if somebody wants to put it out. If they do, great. If they don't, who cares? Let's just do it and get some gigs.
Do you feel like you're in any way reinventing or rebirthing yourself, or are you just taking, you know, what you've already created to the next level?
It's fun because it's actually a return to form, because I started out performing to rooms full of gay men, and now that's kind of what I'm going back to. Last summer, I did a tour of a bunch of gay pride events and gay nightclubs, which is great, and I'll be getting back to that starting in the summer and really probably pushing it around fall. So I'll be getting back to that. So it feels like a return to form. It's really fun and it's good. And I, you know, I just love some Dr. Footlights. That's, you know, it's all I need. All I need for my head.
Well, I'm really excited to hear the music that you create out of your beautiful, sacred soul. And I'm sure everyone
thank
is
you.
Too.
Aww.
And thank you so much for being with us today. It was
absolutely.
Really amazing to talk to you.
It was so
thank
nice
you.
To talk to you, ladies. Come back anytime.
Bye. Yeah, we will.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.